Our conversation with Nancy Evans Bush continues. She wrote this book, Dancing Past the Dark, Distressing Near-Death Experiences. And if, as some listeners have indicated, if they're tuning out for some reason or drifting away, I think you're really doing yourself a disservice. This is some pretty profound stuff we're about to get into, going to the central questions of human existence. Why we're here? Is there a soul? And most importantly, what might come next? We continue the conversation in a moment with the experiences of others who've had the NDE and who've had similar messages, distressing messages delivered to them. Stay with us. Much more to come on Coast to Coast. Nancy, you shared with us the messages that you received while you were in your near-death experience, and it was kind of a cruel message, the idea that, I don't know what this intelligence is out there, some sort of a cosmic prankster or snotty teenagers or whatever, but they are telling you it's all a joke. Your life has been nothing but a dream. It's not real. That message seems unnecessarily cruel, although maybe it was meant to goad you into some sort of action. What interested me, though, is that you are not the only person to get that message. Tell me about some of the other cases that you've investigated.
Well, with the experience of the void, particularly, I think it's important to really to look at this as, and let me go back to my own experience for a second. I had said that the figures I encountered were circles. It was not until 6 years after my experience that I discovered that what I had been thinking of as circles were actually the Chinese yin-yang symbol. And that both presents new questions and also some clues. The questions, of course, are how does a yin-yang symbol get into the experience of a New England Congregationalist who doesn't know what the yin-yang symbol is or anything about what it indicates? And of course, what it indicates is balance and the constant interplay of opposites in our lives, light, dark, good, bad, male, female, up, down, all the dualities, and the importance of balance. But I didn't know that at the time. However, that did give a clue later, many years later, as to how to try to approach reinterpreting my experience. Other people who have similar experiences without encountering the circles, it go through very much the same kind of process. I think of one woman's experience who found herself very much, as with my experience, she found herself floating naked in space. And she hadn't received any particular message except that, here you are, this is it. And she found herself thinking, oh, if only I had some clothing, I could unravel it and make something new out of the threads. Or, oh gosh, I wish I had a chair, because then I could break the chair apart and build something new. Now, that strikes me as a really fascinating kind of takeaway from this experience that in the midst of her sense of annihilation, her sense of being in the void, what she really wanted to do was to be creating something new. Now, someplace in that, there is, it seems to me, a fascinating archetypal message about I guess about insisting that there be some kind of positive outcome. In the myth of the hero's journey, and I've said this in the book too, typically the classic hero's journey involves a scary encounter, journeying, there were monsters, there were dragons, there were terrible experiences. And when the hero gets to the depths of his experience, he finds a gift, which he brings back. And whatever the gift is, the golden apple, the golden fleece, the pearl of great price, he brings it back and it helps save his people. Unfortunately, what we've done in our own Western retelling of this myth, we get as far as the demons, the dragons, the scary parts, and we say, you are being punished. And we leave it there. So we never tell people that they should keep going till they get to the gift. Now, the gift is sometimes, as I mentioned before, not quite what we hoped for. It doesn't bring us wealth and power and the stuff that our society tells us we're supposed to have. But as with the young woman wanting to continue being creative, I think it says enormous things about human spirit and about our capabilities to be more than we think we are. At least I certainly hope that's the case. I think of some other experience, probably the best known of the really frightening experiences is that of Howard Storm, who was an art history teacher at the university level, described himself as being a very sour atheist, had a terrifically detailed, difficult experience, which actually followed the typical experience of the shamanic initiation. In Howard's experience, he felt himself being literally picked apart physically by entities, beings, they weren't monsters, they were just people, but they were clawing at his flesh and taking him apart. Well, in the traditional shamanic experience, that of the medicine men, the holy men, the classic pattern in their deepest experiences is annihilation, restoration, no, annihilation, suffering, and restoration, which is the suffering, death, and restoration, as in resurrection, of the Christian pattern. So in Howard's case, he was physically destroyed in his experience. Then he moved on into a really brilliant, blissful, radiant, affirming part of his experience. And in conclusion, got a whole raft of messages about love, service, the sounds kind of funny to talk about them as, oh, just the typical NDE stuff.
That's okay.
Your life has just been completely taken apart, rebuilt, but it's just ho-hum, another near-death experience. It is not surprising that Howard went on to go into the ministry because of the power of these messages, that there really is more than the physical world, that the values of the non-physical world are immensely important and vital in both its sense as life-giving and its sense of urgency. So he comes back, he takes this all and begins now giving it away in terms of the rest of his life. And this is fairly common.
Well, as I mentioned when I started this question, is that you have found other cases like your own where people receive similar messages from these entities that were pretty nasty. I mean, nasty in the sense it's all a joke, it's all a dream, this is all there is. You could look at that as depressing. You could also look at it as sort of like what the coach yells at his players at halftime. You really screwed up there. You got to get back in there and do better. It's kind of a motivational speech. I mean, a lot of people, I would imagine, take it that way, change their life. Yeah.
Yes, you're absolutely right. For a great many people, the experience is read as, oh my gosh, this is a warning. I have to really look at my life. There's something I need to change. Now, commonly that comes with the sense of, this is a warning. I'm going to hell when I die if I don't shape up. As one young man said, I came back. I turned my life around. I went to Bible college, and now I've taken my fear of death and given it to the scriptures. So for him, his answer was to move into, as I mentioned before, the kind of religious community in which there are definite rules, regulations, if I change my life, I'll be okay. And for a great many people, this is the theme we hear over and over again. I thought I was going to hell, but now I've turned my life around, so I know I'm okay. Interestingly, very frequently, and as a matter of fact, almost always, because these are just ordinary people having these experiences, they come back, they wake up, they say, oh, I have to change my life. What do I change? Typically, if they have not been guilty of horrendous criminal activities. They have not done any, they're not child abusers. They're not terrible people. But they may have a drinking problem, or they may occasionally have a beer and they think that's a drinking problem, but they will stop having the beer. So again, so much of this depends on the individual's interpretation of his own circumstances. People tend to be really tough on themselves. But coming back and identifying what are the things in my life that I need to change, what can I do to smooth the way? This is rarely a bad idea. Just in general purposes. And whether or not one has had an experience, that kind of self-examination to say, what could I be doing differently? What could I be doing better?
Nancy,
what am I doing to hurt somebody?
Nancy, in the world of near-death experience research, and that's not a real big world, and it's more acceptable than it used to be, as you start expressing this new sort of direction of your own research based on many cases that came your way, the idea that there are distressing cases, do you face resistance among colleagues that this new vision might fly in the face of what had already been described as the typical NDE?
Yeah, you could say so. If you think about it, back in when the world was first hearing about near-death experiences at all, the general response was, we were coming as a culture out of a time when death had simply been sequestered. It had moved out of the home into the hospital. People were just denying death left and right. And suddenly into this come the glorious stories of heavenly NDEs. And the response of the public, the response of audiences, was a kind of, they would almost stop breathing. There was such hope. People saying, oh, my mother died. Do you think she might have experienced something like this? Oh, my child just died. Do you think he went to the light? The hope was, I can't begin to express it. Well, who in the world wants to come heavy-footed into this saying, oh, by the way, let me tell you, there's another point of view here.
Yeah, that really makes you the life of the party, doesn't it?
Oh, let me tell you, life of the party indeed. And the assumption, you see, is that the people who have these experiences, and I will say I have encountered this with rather more frequency than I wish were the case, is that if you are interested in these experiences, and particularly if you have had one, you are filled with negativity, hatred, guilt, fear, shame. You are cold. You are hard-hearted. You have attracted this negativity to yourself.
Nancy, there, I'm sorry to cut you off at that key point, but we'll pick up the conversation after this break, and we'll be opening up the phone lines. I know there's a lot of people who are going to want to talk to you. I've got a million questions myself. We're addressing some pretty big questions this evening with my guest, Nancy Evans Bush, author of this book, Dancing Past the Dark. Not all of us can have near-death experiences, but in the meantime, until you have yours, this is a pretty profound book. We've barely scratched the surface tonight. Gets into some pretty heavy questions about who we are, why we're here, and what comes next. We open up the phone lines right after this in our final segment. Stay with us, everyone. More Coast to Coast AM to come. Nancy, I want to ask you one more question before we open up the phone lines. You know, I could see people saying, well, gosh, you must be pushing some sort of religious agenda, or others saying it's an anti-religious message. Maybe it's Christian propaganda. Maybe it's satanic subterfuge.
George,
how does this fit together?
George, I'm having real difficulty with this connection.
Okay.
So can you talk a little slower?
Sure. How does NDE experiences, how do this total experiences fit together with religious beliefs? If you're anti-religious or pro-religious, whatever your religious beliefs might be, is this necessarily in conflict with those or in support of those or neither?
I think neither. Basically, one of the difficulties people have in understanding these things is that they are just not doctrinal. And particularly with a really staunch person of faith from, say, one of the evangelical backgrounds, particularly, these don't line up according to what the book says, not necessarily the good book, but to what the doctrinal stance is, and it just throws people. So that's part of their mystery. They have such power and such intense meanings for people, but they don't fit the pattern.
Does it transcend then preconceived religious ideas? Say there's a fundamentalist who has this experience, that changes then.
Exactly. Yes.
East of the Rockies, Mike in Virginia. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
I just have one quick question for Nancy. And Nancy, it's a pleasure to speak with you. And I find this very interesting. But I'm mainly wondering, do you have any scientists on board with this, whether it be physicists or cosmologists or anyone in your research? Because just by listening to some of the points you've made, you know, I've come up with numerous hypotheses myself that could be relevant without using religion as a, you know, as a reference for this. You know, I'm just curious as to whether there's any actual scientific study going on within this, you know, within the scientific community, whether it be physicists or cosmologists and, you know, whatnot.
Certainly a fair question, Mike. And Nancy, you address it in the book.
George, can you translate for me? We're having a connection problem.
Sure. Mike was asking whether or not there's any scientific backing for NDE research, it is viewed in the science community.
Yes. There has actually, Mike, thanks for this question, been a ton of research from all kinds of directions. None of it has produced anything really conclusive in terms of causation, in terms of just physiological trigger points. We know that these experiences happen to people of all demographic categories. We know they cover all age ranges, all religious, educational, and ethnic backgrounds. There have been, I think it's something like 26 different potential physiological characteristics that have been proposed as explanations, typically, for example, lack of oxygen, temporal lobe seizures, a whole range of potential explanations, none of which has ever proven adequate to explain everything about NDEs and what precipitates them. So it just remains an area of great mystery. There's a good deal of research going on at the moment in the neurosciences in terms of how do these relate to human consciousness in general. There's one study that, the AWARE study by Dr. Samparnia and others, which is due to make some report within the next few months. But again, the questions are so much bigger than our ability to find answers.
Well, the point you made, Nancy, is that there might be all kinds of physiological triggers that lead to the experience, but it doesn't really explain what happens and the profound effects on people after they come back.
Exactly. Exactly.
Certainly a fair question, though, Mike. I think it might be one of those things that science itself, just as pure science, can never solve and maybe isn't supposed to. West of the Rockies, Dave in Washington. Hi, Dave.
Hi, George. I'm not religious, but I'm very spiritual. And to Devin, I thought about...
Dave, are you there? I think we lost...
I'm
are you
here,
there?
But I can't understand the question.
I think we lost Dave, unfortunately. Sorry, Dave.
Okay.
Apologize for that. On the wild card line, Tyler. Good morning, Tyler.
How's it going, man? Yeah, I have a question for a few things. I haven't heard you talk about the release of, which I think has been proven, of DMT after death in the brain, the pineal gland. I know a lot of doctors have done tests and stuff with, DMT experiments, and a lot of what you're explaining seems to kind of sound like what that is, almost. You understand?
Okay, let me rephrase it. Tyler's asking about if you're familiar with experiments with a substance known as DMT and how people who inject this stuff or ingest it otherwise have very similar experiences.
Yes. The DMT experience experiments by Rick Strassman have been really quite interesting. The piece that interests me most particularly is the experiment which Strassman was running was cut short because some of his study participants were reporting experiencing encounters with really frightening creatures in their DMT experience, great insectoid creatures, and this was frightening enough that the whole project was canceled. Not very long after that, I was listening to a report by the American teacher of Buddhism, meditation, Shinzen Young, who was explaining that in some of his own deep meditative experiences, he had encountered these great insectoid grasshopper-like creatures that were enormous. And as Shinzen Young explains it, this is not to be alarmed about, that this is merely the deep unconscious releasing images into your experience, and to recognize these as experiences of consciousness rather than actual external creatures. Now, I just find that a really interesting perspective on this whole business of trying to make sense in a scientific way of experiences that really can't be scientifically quantified. Yes, it's possible to say that ingesting DMT produces sometimes results that are similar to some kinds of spiritual experience, which still leaves us with the same questions of what are these experiences? What are they about? Where did they come from? And somehow trying to take the scientific approach of just saying, well, it's only the response of, say, DMT, still leaves us saying, but what's it about? I don't know if that...
That's a good answer. Let me ask you this, Nancy. You know, the issues you raise go to the heart of questions that we pounce on this program from many different perspectives, the nature of reality itself. I mean, you describing people who come back and say they've been told it's all a dream, that's not unusual to hear. The concept that life isn't real, that it's some kind of a simulation, a computer simulation, that we're a part of a video game of some giant alien nature. Intelligence. That stuff yeah. Comes up more often than not. And it goes to the heart of what reality is.
Yes. Yes. What I have come to myself is, oh gosh, sound bites don't quite do it on this kind of conversation, do they, George?
No, they don't. That's why we're here.
Whether or not we are participants in somebody else's dream, whether or not physical reality is the sum total of reality, I have come to the conclusion that, as I've said in the book, the answers to some questions are just stored on a shelf that is out of our reach. And so I've pretty much stopped trying to answer those, which of course some people will say, well, that's just cowardice on your part. But it's more fatigue, I think, than cowardice. I think this is the point at which we have to make a choice. We can either say, in a thoroughly postmodern way, well, there is no way to have answers for anything. Nothing is real. All is lost, and there's nothing here but nihilism. And we can then float off on a really bleak trajectory. Or we can choose to say, you know, what's it all about? It beats me. But I can make something. It's back to the woman floating in the void. I have a seeming ability to be able to do something with being here. I can make something of it. And it's, I think, up to us what we do make of it. Whether it's, maybe I am a fantasy of some kind. Maybe I am part of a great computer game. But if that's the case, then I had better just be the best possible part of that computer game that I can bring myself to be. I mean, what other option is there? None that makes any sense as far as I can see. And if I'm a goldfish in somebody's goldfish bowl, then hey, be a better goldfish.
One other question, Nancy. I'm sorry, we're not going to get to any more calls. We've got 2 minutes left, I think. Is there some sort of a message about this life, life on Earth, that, you know, you could say, one message would be a better life awaits us. Don't sweat the small stuff. But you could also interpret the total experiences as earthly life does count. Make the most of it. Be good to each other.
I think it would be whatever this is. We are engaged in a gigantic mystery, which is both beautiful and terrible, sometimes at the same time. And it simply behooves us to do our best with it, however we can. And whatever that may mean to us. Basically, I think if we can learn to be decent to each other, we will have gone a long distance to answering questions of meaning and purpose. And maybe even some of the answers hidden on that high shelf.
Well, on that note, I mean, that's a pretty good place to start. Nancy, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the conversation and how much I enjoyed the book. Nancy Evans Bush, her book is called Dancing Past the Dark. I hope you'll check it out. Thanks also to my earlier guests, Dennis Mitchell, Mark Allen, Jeff Ritzman, and thanks to the folks there at Premier as well. Have a good one, everyone. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Good night.